Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Causes or Cures. I'm Dr. Eakes, your host, and thanks so much for joining in. So, some of you might have heard of something called Havana syndrome, a mysterious illness or collection of symptoms targeting those in the intelligence community. It's been in the news quite a bit, and a lot of people are interested in it given its sudden and curious onset. In a previous episode on Causes or Cures, a former CIA officer came on the show to describe his experience with Havana syndrome, which was a detailed personal account. Today, my guest, Dr. James Giordano, was not personally impacted by Havana syndrome, but he was part of the team tasked with investigating the cause of this mysterious illness that first knowingly affected diplomats and members of the intelligence community in 2016. Now, if you've never heard of Havana syndrome, that's okay. Dr. Giordano will tell us more about it in the podcast, as well as who he is, the work he does, and why he was brought on the team to investigate it. I will also include his bio in the podcast description. In addition, he will provide a detailed summary of the investigation in terms of their approach to determining the cause of the mysterious illness and mechanisms of action. And of course, some things he can't share due to confidentiality and depending on what information is classified versus unclassified. You guys know how that goes. He'll discuss the core characteristics of Havana syndrome, essentially a case definition, and how they are investigating potential cases or reports from people who think they might have been affected. He'll talk about theories for what or who might be behind Havana syndrome, the current status of it, meaning what is known, what is being researched, what is being done to compensate those affected, and in the realms of detection and prevention, right? Like, how are we going to keep this from happening in the future? And he'll also offer some recommendations for how the medical and public health communities, media, different agencies should address Havana syndrome in the future. So, give me a couple seconds here, guys, while we connect to Dr. Giordano. So, everyone, we are connecting with Dr. James Giordano, and we're going to talk about Havana syndrome. But first, James, can you tell us more about you and what you do and how you became involved with Havana syndrome?
Oh, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it, and thanks to your audience for their interest in my work. By my training, I'm a forensic neuroscientist. My background is in neuropathology and neurotoxicology, among some other areas of brain science. And I work at the translational interface between those things that are viable for research and those things that occur in the clinical milieu. But a lot of what I've been doing over the past 30 years has also involved the potential ways that the brain sciences can be used in a variety of applications, both within certain types of medicine, such as preventive occupational medicine. In other words, being able to optimize the performance of certain types of personnel, inclusive of personnel in the military, intelligence personnel, as well as the weaponization of various tools and technologies of the brain sciences, which are colloquially referred to as neuroweapons. And these pretty much run the gamut from those things that are fairly familiar to most people, as far as like biological and chemical weapons, drugs, various bugs, microbes, viruses, etc. Toxins, a whole host of organic and some inorganic toxins, but increasingly devices. And this includes a whole host of things that can be used either remotely or directly to affect the brain structure and its various functions of thought, emotion, and behavior. And this also includes possibility for various types of directed energies. And this too runs the gamut from very, very low voltage electrical work to moderate range ultrasonics to things that are a little more sophisticated, inclusive of microwaves and other forms of radio frequency devices. So this is the type of work that I've been doing for the past 40 years or so, 30 years specifically dedicated to neuroweaponology and the way that the United States both has to deal with these things in terms of what our adversaries are doing, but also the way these things need to be controlled on the global stage. So I was contacted in 2016, late 2016, and then recontacted in early 2017 to serve as a forensic neuroscientist based upon a group of cases, an aggregate of cases that had occurred for individuals who were working at the United States Embassy in Havana, Cuba. And I was asked to engage in a process known as abductive forensics, which is pretty much that there was no proverbial entrance wound. There was no proverbial exit wound. There's a lot of things that happened in between, some of these things being subjective symptoms, but also a whole host of objective signs that were assessed through a variety of very, very detailed and highly specific clinical evaluations that suggested that something was really wrong with these people.
Okay, and I know this has been in the news quite a bit, but some people may not know what happened in 2016. So could you give an overview of who was impacted and where and what they experienced?
All right. Well, this affected about 24 individuals who were in the employ of the United States State Department working at the United States Embassy in Havana, Cuba. These individuals were primarily involved with some types of intelligence work, and they'd been on the job. In other words, they'd been doing this type of work, although not exclusively in Cuba, for decades. So we're talking about individuals who are very, very experienced at the job. These individuals began to experience a whole cluster of objective signs and subjective symptoms. The subjective symptoms included things like periodic disorientation, experiencing ringing or buzzing in their ears, feelings of fullness or pain in their head, problems with sleep, problems with appetite, problems with disorientation. And then the objective signs included problems with balance, insomnia, problems with motor coordination, inability to perform even relatively simple cognitive tasks that then only worsened as a consequence of time. What was interesting is that these individuals began to experience these things as a consequence of their experience in their own households. These individuals were not living in government properties. They were living out on the economy in private domiciles. And each and all of them were complaining about these subjective symptoms and objective signs rather discreetly. So there was really not that level of communication between them at the time. But it was really only after the fact when we began to correlate these signs and symptoms, and they had been then undergoing clinical evaluation here in the United States, primarily in Florida and then subsequently in Pennsylvania, that they became aware that others who were involved in similar billet activities were having equivalent, if not equal, signs and symptoms to various levels of severity.
So I know everybody, you know, there was an effort to investigate this, and it involved a lot of people and experts and agencies. I wanted to kind of go through some of that to bring us to where we are now with Havana syndrome. So going back to 2017, the State Department requested that the CDC do an evaluation, right?
It was a multi-level evaluation and prompted investigation. So it was not just the Centers for Disease Control, but also the State Department itself, coupled with the intelligence community and the national academies.
Okay, and then they came up with a working case definition.
Correct. One of the things I was tasked to do throughout 2017 and 2018 was to engage, address, analyze, and come up with some summative conclusions of what was apparent and what could be speculated from what's known as metadata. In other words, not just the information about what happened to those individuals in Havana, but who those individuals were, lifestyle data, prior medical reports, longitudinal histories, as well as their professional histories, and couple that with a host of ecological and environmental data, inclusive of architectural data, geometric data, physical data that actually occurred on site, what the parameters were. And the process then involved something of a process of inclusion and elimination. In other words, what types of things could possibly do this, could cause these objective signs and these subjective symptoms? And then of those things that were possible, given analysis of the data, given analysis of the information, given analysis of the verity of what we then learned to be true or not true, or happening or not happening, what then do we think was most probable to be able to evoke these effects? And that's how the process pretty much went down.
Okay. And I know that there was several theories put forth, and you know, there was chemical, pesticides, ultrasonic, weapons, microwaves. I know they had a consulting group known as Jason that came in and said it was crickets, but that's been totally disproved, right?
Right.
And then
so the nature of the process was both a process of inclusion, what kind of things could do this,
right,
based upon the evidence that was available, would be most probable to do this. So let's take a look at some of the considerations in terms of what I had to go through.
Yeah.
What was it I sorted through? Is it possible that these individuals were exposed to some chemical, a variety of chemicals, as you know, could do this? Certainly many of the pesticides could do this. There are other forms of industrial solvents that could do this. Certain forms of industrial and commercial cleaners can do this. Various forms of painting agents, stripping agents, and architectural agents that can be used for wall considerations. And the individuals would need to be exposed to this at a fairly high concentration over a repeated period of time. And there would be evidence of these chemicals, not only within the individual's tissue samples and fluid samples, but also from the environment. And there was none. As well, the pattern of effect would have been somewhat broader. In other words, anyone who was exposed to these forms of chemicals, essentially, as we call it, downrange, would have had some presentation of signs and symptoms. And this was not the case. These individuals were very, very specific and very selective. So it wasn't as if this represented a broad community or collective exposure, but rather this was a very, very precise pattern of representative signs and symptoms in key individuals. The other possibility is, well, it could it have been that they were exposed to some drug? Might they have been taking some drug, or might they have been inadvertently administered some drug, or perhaps even purposely administered some drug? There are a number of things that could do this, things that are relatively benign, but if taken in high enough doses could be problematic. For example, aspirin. And things that could be far more specific in their effect. Many of the antidiuretic drugs, some of the antineoplastic drugs, the drugs that are used, for example, in cancer chemotherapy, those drugs that can be used as antidiuretic drugs, as well as certain diuretics, could all evoke some of these effects and actions in individuals if indeed the doses were high enough, or if the doses were repeated often enough and frequently and were durably enough. But in each of those cases as well, there would have been some telltale biomarker. There would have been some residual metabolite, given the necessity of these drugs to be given in those concentrations and doses that would have evoked those effects, or to be given in repeated doses over a period of time. I mean, there would have been some attribute or artifact that would have been traceable, therefore identifiable in these individuals' biological samples. There was nothing. The other issue is, well, could it have been possible that these individuals might have been exposed to some form of electronic or other form of energetic device? Might it have been that part of their communication equipment, for example, may have gone awry, and that may have subjected them to altered areas of spectral frequencies from these electronic equipment that could have been problematic for them? Yeah, that was certainly a possibility. Might it have been possible as well that these individuals could have been downrange of some other form of directable energy, such as an ultrasonic device? A case in point that we considered is that we know that there are types of rangeable ultrasonic devices that are widely used and commercially purchasable as anti-vermin devices to repel mammals of a variety of sizes. These are widely used, for example, in Europe for that exact purpose. And we also recognize that there are devices of a similar sort that are marketed directly for protection against home intruders. And now we're not talking about small mammals, we're talking about humans. And the issue here is that perhaps, that given that these individuals were in a private domicile, living out on the economy, and it was known that these individuals were, in fact, American, could it have been possible that these types of devices may have been installed in and around these individuals' apartments and their domiciles so as to keep vermin away? In other words, look, these are Americans. They don't really want to have vermin crawling all over. You might have had a problem with fill-in-the-blank mice, rats, weasels, whatever. So let's install these things, and that should keep that population of pests away. Possible? Completely possible. Now, what are the constraining factors? Well, number one, the individuals would have to be within a particular range of these devices so as to be able to get the specific effects that were incurred. And they have to be pretty close, because the nature of these devices is that they're in close devices because they are commercially marketed for that. So again, abusability or misusability of these devices has a rather narrow margin. Point number one. So there would be some at least evidence of these devices being in their domicile or around their domicile that would then be recoverable. That was not the case. Number two, there would have been some custodial record. The devices had to be purchased. The devices had to be installed. It would have to be, for example, sort of extracted if they were removed. And there would be record of that. Not necessarily to throw anyone under the proverbial bus, but there would have been some custodial and or provenance record of purchase and use, even if that, for whatever reason, might have been inadvertent. A simple mea culpa, hey, you know, this was just not installed correctly, or there wasn't consideration for variables X, Y, and Z that may have been burdensome or problematic to individuals downrange. Easy fix. There was no record of that. As well, there was no record of individuals having a broad exposure to these types of things. So in other words, once again, if in fact you and I are living in an apartment and you're next to me, why is it that I'm only getting affected? You're not getting affected. So here, once again, the actual pattern, the distributional effects did not line up with what might be a generalizable, universal use of these types of devices for what we might call benign or even benevolent aims. So here, too, that was a problem. Then we thought, well, let's go one step further. Might it be that perhaps these individuals may have some type of microbe, might they have been exposed to some fungus? Might they have gotten some infection, whether with some cryptic virus or a bacterial infection or some combination of all of the above? But this would have been indicated, as you know, in their comprehensive blood work. Even if it were a latent exposure, there would have been some residual signs as relates to their complete blood counts that would have suggested, again, by use of what's called a differential, in other words, looking at various populations of immunocytes and white blood cells, that, yeah, these individuals were exposed to a fungus or a parasite or bacterial infection or a virus. And that was not the case, number one. Number two, the pattern of distribution was very, very different than that which you might see of this type of an infectious disorder. Then we have to consider one additional thing. Is it also possible that this may be something psychogenic, something sociogenic, or what is sometimes referred to as a functional neurological disorder? Now, let's consider what functional neurological disorders are. These are disorders primarily of the sensory and motor system that occur as a consequence of changes in central neurological activity. So that's a fancy way of saying that there are things that occur in your brain, and as a consequence of these changes in brain node and network activity, they manifest effects that can influence the way an individual senses certain things across a variety of senses, most notably touch, but also hearing, vision, in some cases, what individuals smell, and the ability to move in certain ways, in some cases, actually producing impairments in movement. Yet there doesn't seem to be anything there. If we actually examine these individuals neurologically, there's nothing to suggest that there's neurological damage in the peripheral or central nervous system. So it's not a structural disorder per se, but it's a functional change, a disordering of nervous system activity that controls these aspects of the sensorium or of motor outputs and behaviors. Is it possible that these individuals were exhibiting functional neurological disorders? 100% possible if that was the case. Absolutely. However, here once again, these individuals did not fit the pattern. Now, there's been some discussion to date as to, well, look, can't functional neurological and or psycho or sociogenic illnesses and disorders occur in anyone? Yes, they can. Absolutely. So what makes these individuals any less vulnerable than Sally or Joe Schmuckatelli walking down the street? Well, really nothing. But for the fact that the actual physical patterns of expression differed and were distinct from what you would see in functional neurological disorders and or psychogenic disorder. To the latter point, as regard to psychogenic and sociogenic disorders, very important consideration there is that there needs to be some communication so as to enable the spread of the disorder, if you will. In other words, it has to be communication from me to you, and then that has to hit some level of vulnerability and viability in you, and bang, that triggers it in you, and so forth and so on. That was not the case among these individuals at that time on site. There wasn't that level of communication, nor was that level of expression of, hey, these things are going on with me. How about you? The other issue was, is it possible this represented a job-induced stress? And there are examples, certainly, of intelligence personnel being relatively new on station or being on station for a while who then develop these types of psychosociogenic or professionogenic types of disorders that are primarily manifest like things like twitching or various other sensory or motor tics or disorders or expressions for individuals, for example, who are stationed in Moscow that used to be considered to be the Ivan's itch or Ivan's eye. The idea there is that, okay, they're nervous enough about something and they begin to manifest signs and symptoms. Was it that? Well, that was certainly a consideration early on. Here, once again, the uniformity and representation of the patterns, not only in terms of what these individuals subjectively experience. I mean, I could tell you I'm subjectively experiencing anything. And there too, I mean, that could be representative of something or nothing. But it's correlating their subjective experiences and presentations with very, very detailed clinical assessments that could not be faked, given the level of representation, granularity, specificity, and precision. Those things just couldn't be faked. And those patterns of response in terms of these individuals' inner ear function, balance function, coordinative function, cognitive functions were to the extent that not only could they not be faked, but they were greater than what one might see with other forms of functional neurological disorder, at least with regard to the way they were tested.
Okay.
So what we were left with was something physical happened to these individuals. What we mean by that is not something that came from the inside out, but rather something from the outside in. These individuals appear to have been physically affected by something, and the pattern by which these effects were manifest were strongly supportive in reinforcing that these individuals appeared to be specifically identified and targeted.
Okay. So I'm in the 2022 declassified report that's available for anyone online, the IC Experts Panel on Anomalous Health Incidents, which is what they're calling, I guess, Havana Syndrome. I don't know if those two words are interchangeable.
Yeah, they're overlapping. In other words, these types of things where individuals show these signs and symptoms are considered to be AHIs.
Okay.
And then the question is whether or not they fit into the Havana Syndrome more specifically.
Okay. I wanted to go back. In that report, they talk about the four core characteristics. And, you know, and having a background in public health and epidemiology, I think about how you need to have a case definition. Are these four core characteristics the working case definition, which include the acute onset of audio vestibular sensory phenomena, sometimes including sound or pressure in only one ear or on one side of the head, or other nearly simultaneous signs and symptoms such as vertigo, loss of balance, and ear pain, a strong sense of locality or directionality, and the absence of known environmental or medical conditions that could have caused the reported signs and symptoms? Those are the four core characteristics. Is it fair to call that the working case definition?
Yeah, it's completely fair and completely accurate to consider these as the core constellation of features that are also accompanied by cognitive deficits that range from relatively severe, although variable in their durability, to moderately severe with regard to their perdurability and permanence. And in some cases, these individuals were rendered unable to resume their four-letter task within the scope of their job. Some of the individuals were not able to go back to work in that position at all, whereas others were able to return to the position, but there was some restriction and constraint in what it is that they could do because of the cognitive incapabilities and dysfunctions that they were experiencing. So the addition is not just these ocular and vestibular effects that would then manifest by changes in balance, positioning, experiences of vertigo, not just dizziness, but true vertigo.
Yeah.
The actual presentation itself, but also the cognitive defects that rendered these individuals rather cognitively and capably disabled.
So the working theories, so right now, pulsed electromagnetic energy, that the most plausible?
Yes, ma'am. Some form of directed energy. Originally, back in 2017 and 18, based upon the data that were available to me and to colleagues, most probable source of this energy was some form of rangeable acoustic ultrasonic device. The reason for that is multifold. Number one, it fits the actual pattern of effect in terms of what types of effects these might occur with regard to the tissues, both solid tissues as well as fluid components of the inner ear, both the middle ear and the deeper inner ear, and then the communication of those effects to other fluid aspects within the inner ear, inclusive of bloodstream, which would then have a communicating effect to brain, that would produce something that would be very, very similar to the type of insult or injury we'd see with decompression sickness. In other words, it would cause a cavitation, a bubbling, a turmoil within fluid membranes, as well as a very, very high vibration of many of the solid tissues of the inner ear that would then overexcite those neurological structures that would be leading up into the brain and then ultimately cause a change in their excitability pattern. This causes something called excitotoxicosis, where you literally overramp those cells and cause them to be so excited they become toxic. And as a consequence, they become dysfunctional. But also there was disruption of blood flow to the brain such that it produced, again, a constellation of symptoms that could be described as a traumatic brain injury, a mini stroke, but far more representative of what we see with neurological manifestations of decompression sickness. So the issue here was that initially we saw that the technological readiness level of these types of directed energy was certainly appropriate for their fieldability, scalability, and operationalizability. We know that these things were in viable use, development, testing, and application, not only here in the United States and by the United States, but by international peer competitors as well, Russia, China, etc. So the technology was there. It's available technology. The initial patent for these forms of rangeable acoustic and ultrasonic devices was first formed in the United States by a research exchange development agreement that occurred between the United States Navy and commercial entities here in the States. But copycat versions of these types of devices exist elsewhere, and we are aware of their use in industrial occupational safety and health testing in China, as well as in the former Soviet Union, then ultimately today in Russia. So we were initially very strongly wedded to the idea and exploring further and then fortifying the probability that these types of things that we're seeing were in fact caused by some form of directed energy of the ultrasonic variety. We considered at the time other forms of directable energy. And the one that was most prominent in that consideration, again in 2017 and 18, was microwave energy. The problem we had with microwave energy at that time was based upon the initial analyses, the technological readiness level of rapidly pulsable microwaves that did not elicit a thermal signature and that did not have astronomically large requirements for power sources that would really sort of constrain or impede their ability to be flexibly used without like being overt. I mean, without having to like have a microwave transmitting unit that was, you know, the size of a Volkswagen. Well, we really didn't see that technology readiness was apparent in such a way that would allow it to be operationalized in these ways. We recognized that those types of technologies and technical developments were certainly viable and available here in the United States. However, the international or multinational development and readiness of those technologies was not apparent to us in 2018. And it was then only realized subsequently in later 2018 and early 2019 that other nations' technological acumen and progress in scalable, very, very rapidly pulsed microwaves using primarily laser sources for the pulsing would render these types of devices highly scalable, very fieldable, and then operationalizable with very much reduced power source requirements that could also make their use relatively clandestine. So we revised our initial hypothesis and probabilistic speculation. And that also helped us to make some sense out of some of the other findings, some of the other medical findings of these individuals that suggest that there are other problems. There were manifest problems that were not exactly of the type that you might see with just ultrasound, but suggest that they might have been exposed to something else. And certainly microwave energy is capable of causing this type of functional derangement in neurological activity that would then produce many of the signs and symptoms that we're seeing in these individuals. So in conclusion, what we came up with is that it appears that either or both of these types of directed energy seem to be the most probable candidates for what was the offending stimulus. Now, was it ultrasound alone? Was it microwaves alone? Was it some combination of ultrasound and microwaves? The answer appears to be yes, all of the above. However, it then becomes, I think, incumbent upon any definition or description of those types of things to say, well, why was this done? Was this a surveillance exercise that ran awry? That's still possible. I mean, certainly, the use of these types of technologies for advanced surveillance and interruption of communication, well known. It was also possible that this was not just surveillance, but also intended disruption, both of the signals themselves and of the signaling agents themselves. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so when most people think about microwave radiation, it's non-ionizing radiation. And so most people are familiar with ionizing radiation and they know that's linked to cancer. And I know, you know, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, an agency of the World Health Organization, in 2011 classified radio frequency electromagnetic fields, microwave energy, as a group 2B or a possible carcinogen. There's a possible increased risk for brain tumors and acoustic neuromas, but the evidence was inadequate to draw conclusions. I know the National Toxicology Program, part of the U.S. Health Department of Health and Human Services, is doing animal studies, mostly on cell phone exposure, which is microwave radiation. I'm also familiar with the Frey effect. And for our listeners, in 1961, Alan Frey stated that microwave radiation could cause audible buzzes or clicks, or something he called microwave hearing. He was dismissed at that time. I guess, could you, when you say that we know that microwave radiation can cause biological damage, could you explain what we know, right? What you know, how the mechanism of action, how does that happen? And does it matter? I guess, does it matter, you know, how much you're getting, how long you're exposed for it? What do we know about that?
The symmetry always matters. I mean, realistically, just a tiny dose of something, particularly if that tiny dose is a single dose that doesn't occur once again, may have absolutely negligible effect. And if the dosimetry and dosing themselves is low enough or infrequent enough, well, then I think what you're looking at is a very low probability of sustainable effect, a broad effect across a range of individuals whose physical characteristics, size, anthropometries, settings may differ. Right? But if you want to get more of that impactful effect, then this has to actually be directed within a particular set of parameters. A lot of the studies you were quoting are examining the effects of microwave radiation, non-ionizing radiation, on carcinogenesis, are using much, much higher exposures and are using much, much higher doses, concentrations of microwave energy to be able to then try to elicit those more durable changes that you would see that would affect the genetic stability of cells that could then prompt some type of carcinogenesis, or at very, very least, some type of what medically is referred to as a neoplastic conversion. In other words, some abnormality in the way these cells begin to reproduce and then subsequently differentiate. So the characteristic changes that we see in cancerous and precancerous tissues, going from some form of anaplasia then into a more profound anaplasia, but then does not have bowel differentiation, problematic, requires much higher levels of microwaves and or longer durations. But at lower levels of microwave frequency and intensity, as well as pulsing, and for shorter exposures and multiple short exposures, you're still getting the actual wave disruptive effect that the microwave elicits in any biological or physical substrate, which is that the microwave does exactly as the waveform would indeed incur. In other words, you get expansions and contractions that are then disruptive to both physical structures and to the energetic structures and functions that those physical structures are involved with or subserve. So the threat with a microwave in these types of situations isn't so much their possible induction of carcinogenesis, although, of course, that is a risk with longer-term durable exposure or higher doses, but rather the functional disruption to cellular membranes and the various physical activities and ionic activities that those membranes are involved with, not only on the single cell level, but on the cell system level and on the systemic level writ large. This is particularly the case for interactive and communicative tissue, such as nerve. So the microwave-induced disruption of the membrane stability, not only the structural stability, but the ionic and electroionic capability of those membranes essentially disrupts their network properties. You know, there's that old adage in neuroscience that nerve cells that fire together wire together. And although we've really moved away from the idea of hardwired diagrams and tracts within the brain, recognize it doesn't exactly work that way. Not so much like an electrical line or a telephone line, but far more like a Wi-Fi type system. Disruption of that system integrity, disruption of the patterns of node and network activity, can lead to somewhat more durable changes in those patterns of node and network activity that can be disruptive at least and dysfunctional and disordered at worst.
Okay, and just, and you mentioned this earlier, but just for the listeners, this is separate from the thermal effects of microwave radiation.
So there's two ways to really reduce the thermal artifact of microwaves. One is to make sure that the microwave energy itself is exceedingly low, and also to make sure that the actual transmission of the microwave itself is exceedingly rapid. Now, we're talking about a scale of rapidity that is very, very, very fast. We're talking about nanoseconds. But what we're able to do with that is that by shrinking down the actual time availability of the thing is pulsed, you're also decreasing both the energy requirement and the energy delivery. And that energy delivery is translated into the energetics of the force, but not the energetics of the thermal transfer. So what we're seeing here is that by rapidly pulsing these microwaves, what you're able to do is reduce the overall energy required, maintain the relative force of the transmission and its diffused effects, and also reduce any thermal signature.
Okay, so that's why nobody reported feeling a lot of heat, for example.
Correct.
Okay. So for the plausibility of this to work, a device would have to be installed inside a building somewhere, right?
No. Portable devices of both the acoustic and ultrasonic variety, as well as these types of rapidly scalable and rapidly pulsed microwaves, are exactly that. They're scalable and fieldable. They don't need to be permanently mounted.
They don't need to be. But in this case,
it was likely that they were not.
It was likely that they were not.
They were not permanently mounted. The likelihood there is that they were actually delivered to the site and were relatively portable.
Oh, so not concealed behind a wall or something like that?
No, ma'am.
Got it. Okay. And could you, I know there's some things you can't talk about, I'm sure, but I'm just curious for the length of exposure, and of course, there's going to be individual variations, I'm sure, but can you say for about how long someone needs to be exposed to something like this on average for them to experience these four core symptoms or characteristics?
It also depends on the intensity of the exposure. So let me explain.
Okay.
Knowledge of physical space in which these individuals were in would certainly help. So in other words, if you get them in an area where they're relatively in a fixed position or static position for a while, well, that helps because they're not moving around and you can actually target them more specifically. I mean, like anything else. I mean, the easiest way to target something is to get a good bearing on it and hold the bearing and then discharge them. The same is true with regard to understanding what the physical parameters are in the environment in which this individual is. Are there things going to interfere with the transmission of that energy? Absorptive things, things that are going to interrupt the relative line of sight or non-line of sight of the energetic transfer and effect. What is the actual nature of the materials that the individual is surrounded by or the ecology in which they're in? And is that going to be conducive or disruptive to a transfer of energy or a promulgation of the energetic effects? And then there's the individual themselves. I mean, certainly having at least some knowledge of the anthropometry of the individual, their relative size, for example, could be very helpful. Is it absolutely necessary to be able to generate the effect? No, particularly if the purpose here is a probing effect, something of a beta type test. In other words, let's see how much or how effective these things are under a variety of different conditions. And that seems to have been the most likely scenario, is that these individuals were differentially exposed to forms of directable energy, whether it was some form of ultrasonic energy, microwave energy, or some combination of both, under a variety of exposure conditions and durations to evoke a host of potential effects that we then see as expressed as the spectrum that is now being called these AHIs of the Havana syndrome, these anomalous health incidences of the Havana syndrome.
Okay. And that report that I was quoting from, that didn't deal with motives or who might be doing it. But I know that there was also the CIA interim report in 2022, January, which was not conclusive. It's an interim report, I suppose, but they said that the majority of the 1,000 reported cases were unlikely caused by a foreign actor.
Let me interject here. So sure. I think it becomes very, very easy to sort of conflate a variety of different factors that are part of the entirety of this circumstance, situation, and to some case problem. It becomes very, very important to take these things in turn and specifically. Let's only talk about the individuals in Havana, those 24 individuals in Havana. So what we saw with those individuals in Havana was that these signs and symptoms were strongly supportive, and in all cases that we had from Havana, highly probabilistic of some exposure to some form of directed energy, and based upon subsequent analysis, either ultrasonic and or some form of rapidly pulsable non-thermal microwave energy. These are the individuals in Havana. Okay. For those individuals, many of the signs and symptoms that they experienced were durable and had longer term effect. And we're also able to rule out other issues and possible causative factors, including things like psychogenic and sociogenic effects in those individuals, functional neurological disorder in those individuals, or inadvertent or even targeted exposure to various chemicals, microbes, and toxins. So in those individuals, the uniquity of those cases is such that it preserves the integrity of this diagnosis. Those core features are what we see as hallmark of those cases in Havana. Now, the question of who done it and yeah, what the underlying motives are, well, that certainly was above my pay grade. I think what becomes important to understand is who has the technology. And based upon who has the technology, that at least positions you from some relative vantage point to be able to explore who may have done it. Well, look, first and foremost, I mean, let's not be naive. The United States and its international economic, bioscientific, and technological allies and cooperators certainly have not only access to the technology, but in some cases were the developers of technologies such as these, if not the technologies specific to these types of effects themselves. So yeah, does the United States possess these types of technologies? Of course we do.
Yeah,
absolutely. Do our allies? Of course we do. Is that saying, oh, the United States did it? Of course it isn't.
Uh-huh.
But is it also possible, for example, particularly if some foreign actor, whether national or non-state, cares not about United States patent laws, regulations, guidances, and constraints to be able to acquire this information so as to be able to reverse engineer such a device, or to be able to produce such a device based upon adapting something to be available over the counter? Yeah. As well, we have to go one step further and ask the question, well, what other nations have dedicated research programs that have advanced to the point of test evaluation, in some cases application for at least investigational use? And here we see our two major international competitors, China and Russia, both of whom are using these types of technologies in occupational safety and health evaluations, investigations, and testing, so as to be able to assess the effects of whether it's ultrasonic and or microwave energies on a variety of physical materials, inclusive of organic material. So The dilemma we're faced with is, yes, there are, in fact, known examples of this technology that are extant, that are, quote, out there, that have been developed and that are put into use. And certainly we understand that, quote, the big three, the United States and its allies, as well as our international peer competitors, Russia and China, are equally involved in, committed to, and have examples of the technology. But once again, that does not in any way afford a finger of attribution to be pointed. Is it possible that second and third order proxies may have been provided the technologies? Sure. Is it also possible that these technologies, or at least the plans for these technologies, may have been acquired by other actors with capricious or nefarious intent? Sure. Does it become very, very difficult and touchy on a variety of levels, bioeconomic levels, levels of international provenance, international capability, and postures, as well as political and military postures to make certain accusations about attribution without very formative, definitive evidence of the proverbial smoking gun? Yeah, it is. Further, given certain developments on the world stage subsequent to 2016, those developments have, I think, other implications for various aspects of geopolitical and military interactions that might dictate playing certain types of attributions, suspicions of attributions, and assertions of attribution far closer to the vest. At very, very least, because it also would allow for a far more directed and therefore effective and efficient programmatic engagement towards being able to detect these types of things, mitigate or prevent these types of things. In other words, you don't necessarily want to throw the card out that says, know what this is, we gotcha, because then what you're doing is you're essentially changing the playing field and you may be inducing some level of brinksmanship, which was an active consideration throughout the course of the investigation as to how much information needs to be expressed, needs to be communicated, and whether the level of these investigations should be open source and or declassified or unclassified, or whether they should be at least classified, if not classified top secret, or exist on the confidential unclassified space.
I wanted to ask, after the incidents in that happened in Havana, and when they started investigating this, and even beyond Havana, and I know we're focusing on Havana here, but they encourage reporting of any kind, right? Just they wanted to try to, I guess, assess the scope of this. So they said, report, report, report. Is that right?
No, ma'am. That's incorrect. It's only been a fairly recent development that occurred following 2020 or into early 2021, primarily based upon the very strong invocation of Secretary Austin.
Okay.
And based upon initiatives that were undertaken by the Biden administration, and part of that, those initiatives carried forth from some of the existing policies and postures of both Obama administrations that were very encouraging of any report of any kind of anomalous activity that may be a threat to U.S. personnel worldwide. So, for example, renewed investigations, for example, of Gulf War syndrome and Gulf War signs and symptoms.
Okay.
Obviously, was escalated during the Obama administration. And I must tell you that working directly in this process from the years late 2016, 2017 through the present, and working primarily with those cases in Havana, there was considerable pushback and relative unease, and in some cases, just ambiguity on the administrative side about, number one, accepting the veridicality of what had happened despite the existing and overwhelming evidence, and number two, mobilizing on that veridicality so as to be able to provide resources for both ongoing and further proactive and prospective assessment of others who may have been reporting similar, if not identical, findings, as well as continued care of those individuals who experienced these anomalous health incidences in Havana. The real turning point actually occurred in late 2020, early 21, as a consequence of some of the revisions and then reinstantiations of policies, guidelines, and directorates within the Biden administration to then devote funds to these AHIs of the Havana syndrome and more broadly, and the very, very strong once again, invocation of Secretary Austin, granting all individuals who feel that they may have been subjected to this type of thing to come forward without fear of bias or stigma.
Right, right. No, and I'm sure that that is a legitimate concern. I was just, I keep going back to the four core characteristics and, you know, the symptoms. Some of the symptoms can be nonspecific for a lot of different things. I was just wondering about how they were managing those reports. And
so, you know, when you open up, when you encourage the opening up of the proverbial spigot.
Yes.
In other words, you're saying, all right, look, there will be no stigmatization, there'll be no biasing. We encourage anyone who feels that they have signs and symptoms that may be reflective or representative of these type of AHIs, whether it's Havana syndrome type or perhaps something else, to come forward. Well, obviously what you're then doing is you're putting out, quote, a cattle call. I mean, I don't mean to be at all derogatory, but you're saying is anyone who feels they may have these types of signs and symptoms come forward.
Yes.
So what then becomes important is to dedicate the resources of time, the resources of services, the resources of personnel necessary to be able to differentiate, if you will, the wheat from the chaff. So what do we mean by the chaff, so to speak? Again, not to be in any way derogatory, but there, as you say, and as others have noted, there are a lot of things that can produce clinical signs and symptoms that fall within this general constellation that represent key points or key facets, but may not represent the entirety. In other words,
right,
the parts may be there, but not in a sufficient presentation to warrant the assessment, diagnosis, or classification of the whole.
Yes.
Like what? Well, let's face it. To this point in time, to 2023, there are well over 1,000 reported cases of individuals who feel that they may have signs and symptoms representative of just this type of thing. In full transparency, and I'm being 100% literal with you, there is not a week that goes by that I personally don't receive an email or some other form of contact from an individual or individuals who feel that they may have been downranged to just this type of an event. In some cases, we're talking about many of these such reports coming to me a week. So we're finding now that there are thousands of reports and that the onerous task is to be able to sift through these reports, taking each and all of them at face value as being at least representative of what these individuals feel, and then moving appropriately so as to assess these individual reports, categorize these individual reports pragmatically and prudently, and then provide at least some form of relative engagement towards treatment, irrespective of whether the individuals actually have an AHI of the Havana syndrome type or have something else. So let's face it. I mean, there are, as you've been mentioned, a whole host of potential neuro-otologic disorders that could produce this type of thing, a schwannoma, in other words, an auditory and or vestibular nerve tumor could produce these type of signs and symptoms. Meniere's disease, an inflammatory disease of the inner ear, could certainly produce these types of symptoms. Sinus infections could. A host of immunological or rheumatological disorders could. And of course, individuals who have neurological conditions, both peripheral and central, of a variety of sorts, individuals who may have certain problems with blood pressure homeostasis, high blood pressure, low blood pressure as a consequence of cardiovascular change, may present signs and symptoms such as this, as well as individuals who have certain forms of what is medically referred to as psychological underlay or overlay. In other words, pre-existing psychological characteristics that may predispose them to appreciating certain signs and symptoms they may have and regarding them in these ways as being pathologic or pathologically representative of the Havana syndrome. I mean, here we're going literally the gamut from things that are fairly mild, like the worried well, individuals who may be in a position where they're working in DC or working around a government building. They may have certain symptoms, you know, subjective feelings. They may have certain objective signs, and they may think, well, hey, I'm worried. Could this be a valid worry, of course? There are also individuals who are somewhat more hypochondriacal. And if we move along the spectrum of psychological underlay and or overlay, We can see that there may be particular comorbid or premorbid psychological conditions that can also express as inappropriate worry, concern, in some cases paranoia, conspiratorial constructs and ideas. So what are we really faced with? Right now in 2023, we have about 24 cases from Havana who have been validated and verified that something happened to those individuals.
Right.
Wasn't functional neurological disorder, wasn't psychogenic or sociogenic, it certainly wasn't crickets.
Right.
We also have a little greater than 100 individuals who are currently in a verification and validation pipeline who appear to have something physically have happened to them. Mm-hmm. And many of the metadata or correlative data variables are also supportive and therefore inferential that there is a probability that something like this may have happened to them as well. But still, consider what we're dealing with here. We're still dealing with an N of less than 200.
Right.
In the face of literally well over 1,000 reports.
Right.
Per the National Academy's report and the intelligence community report, those reports were accurate in their assessment and description that the majority of reported cases to date do not represent disorders of the anomalous health incident Havana syndrome type, but represents something different. That doesn't mean those individuals should not seek treatment. That doesn't mean there's not something wrong with those individuals. Mm-hmm. It just means that what's wrong with those individuals is not reflective, representative, and therefore probabilities that it's Havana syndrome.
Right, right. And I think it was, it's important to distinguish that because you don't want to take away from the legitimacy of these people who meet the working case definition. Like this is a real thing.
Nor do you want to take away the validity of individuals who are suffering from something else.
I agree.
The issue there is the best interests of the patient represent the primacy of the direction of medical intervention and care. And part of that is assessing what is wrong with those individuals and providing them the treatment they need as specific to what is wrong with them.
Yeah.
The error is an error of assumption to state that, well, you know, anytime you hear, you know, hoofbeats in the forest, one must assume it's a zebra. No, it is very likely a horse. And very often, as the horse runs through the forest and you're seeing the differential shadowing coming through the trees, it could look like a zebra, but it's not a zebra.
Yeah.
In other cases, damn, it's actually a zebra. So I think the important thing here is to remain vigilant and dedicated to these ongoing assessments. And of course, the then responsible care to any and all individuals who come forward with a diagnosable entity, irrespective of what that may be.
Uh-huh.
But specifically, when we're talking about these types of AHIs that are reflective of the type of thing that happened to individuals in Havana, and appears to have happened to a number of other individuals in a more sort of geographically distributed pattern, those individuals represent for sure something that is reflective of a national biosecurity and national biodefense, if not public health issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Some people are comparing this to what happened. They're comparing Havana syndrome to what happened in the 1950s at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. Do you have any thoughts on that?
It's the 1950s in Moscow. Technology marches on. The intent, I think, was certainly apparent, as was the motivation, as was the dedication to the engagement of the task. The variety of the currently available state-of-the-art techniques and technologies were employed in a disruptive way that was at least clandestine with regard to its application administration, if not initially an attempt at being covert, would suggest, as we well know, that very often any type of clandestine and or covert engagement, particularly of this type, that has a very strong, what is referred to as non-kinetic flavor to it. In other words, you haven't really crossed the boundary of saying this represents a hostile act that is therefore assessable and attributable to a hostile actor with these intents for disruption and destruction, but rather exists sort of in that gray zone, kind of right at the border of, well, did it really happen or did it not? Very difficult to gain attribution in terms of who did it. And if you get the attribution of who did it, it's an after the fact, and then you have to demonstrate that or prove that. We've come a long way in terms of the science and technology that is developed, available, scalable, and usable in these operational scenarios since the 1950s. But then what the 1950s provide is something of a template, a paradigmatic example of the intent and viability of using currently available state-of-the-art science and technology for these means and these ends.
Right. Because they were supposedly beaming microwaves at the embassy, with the top floor of the embassy, or turning surveillance devices on. It seems like they're doing a better job, though, at least caring about the reports and what people are saying than they did then, because it didn't seem like those folks back then had a lot of support when they, the diplomats in Moscow and that kind of thing.
Well, there are other things to get into that. Number one was that the level of public support for those individuals would have also explicitly and openly communicated the United States and its allies' involvement in particular operations within the sovereign state of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And so any explicit description that these things were happening to these people that were doing this job would have also been an admission of this job being done. And, you know, you were at the initiation and beginning this sort of real escalation of the Cold War. And those types of admissions were simply anathema to the posture of both the United States and its allies, as well as the Soviet Union.
I agree. There's still people's lives, you know.
Yeah, I'm not, there's a couple of things you have to sort of consider. Number one is the overall posture and regard for individuals in harm's way.
Yeah.
As well as consideration of what types of things could do certain things in the 1950s versus the 2000s. So it's very, very loose. What you're looking at is 50 years of what I'll call progress. The progress is not only scientific and technological in terms of what the science and engineering devices can do, but also the relative progress that occurs as a consequence of the posture of the biomedical edifice in the United States, particularly within the federal government, to be able to regard and treat those of its personnel that may be in harm's way in their best interest, and not simply in those ways that are force effective for the mission of the government, the military, or the intelligence community.
Right.
So again, the scenarios changed in the past 60 years.
Yes. Yes, I would agree with that. I actually don't know, and maybe you know, if there was a follow-up study on those people who were in the embassy, if they followed them.
There have been more than one. Some of those follow-ups are psychosocial in terms of actually looking at what happened to those individuals psychosocially in terms of their various professional and personal capabilities, acumen and disability, if any. Yeah. And others were far more biomedical, and then others had sort of military and political ramifications.
Okay. Let final question here. I could talk about this stuff all day. I find it interesting. I'm really glad you came on to talk about it. What, you know, recommendations going forward, what you can talk about, what you can share publicly with us, what is being done to help those who have been affected and, you know, are still suffering? And you see people who have been afflicted and speaking publicly, they seem to be going through a really, you know, tough time, and with possible long-term consequences for sure. So I guess what's being done to help those people? That would be my first question. And then my other question is, what's being done to prevent this type of thing from happening?
Well, let me speak to the former first, because I can do so very, very openly. Whereas the latter, there are particular constraints upon what kinds of things I can discuss and to what level of granularity and detail I can discuss it. So let's take a look at the former. In other words, what are we doing for those people? I mean, for any of those people, any of those individuals who come forward with a report and the suspicion of their experience that something's happened to me, I need to figure out what it is. Well, where do you go from there, so to speak? Well, first and foremost, I think it's important for these individuals to seek medical help. So getting the necessary assessments, getting the necessary, at least initial evaluations from their physician, even to the point of the physician saying, look, I really don't know what's going on here, but something's going on here. Or having the physician say, oh, you do have an idea of what's going on here. Yeah, you're having these signs and these symptoms, but it's because you have an inner ear tumor. It's because you have Meniere's disease. It's because you have intermittent hypotension as a consequence of taking these drugs. That's what's causing these things. I actually had an individual who got in touch with me over the past year and began their conversation with, I was diagnosed having a brain tumor, and then went on to explain a variety of their clinical signs and their subjective symptoms. Correct. You have a brain tumor. That's what's causing this. How long have you had the brain tumor? Well, this is a brain tumor that was essentially a benign tumor. It was operated on once before, but it seems to be coming back. It's coming back slowly. I've had this for the past 25 years. These effects that you're experiencing are consequential to your brain tumor and its manifestations in your central nervous system and physiology. It's not Havana syndrome. I'm using that as an extreme example. The reason I say that is that the first step is exceedingly important for individuals who feel that they may have been exposed to this type of thing, is to become evaluated by a competent healthcare professional, their private physician, whoever he or she may be, a nurse practitioner, a physician's assistant, who has knowledge of their condition, who has the capability to provide at least some level or attempt at differential diagnosis. If at that point it then becomes apparent that something's going on here that is not easily diagnosable or attributable to either a current or pre-existing condition of a known entity, well, the next stage is, well, what do we do about this? The next stage is the referral stage. And that referral stage can go through a number of different channels. Realistically, it's always best if the individual's clinician initiates and then executes that referral. But where? Well, here, once again, there's some geographic things that need to play into the fold, but realistically, going to the public health department, the state public health department, and then ultimately that could get sent up the chain to more national level resources. In terms of the actual national level resource that seems to have been most instrumental and therefore effective in both diagnosing, confirming, and then engaging in the proper levels of neurocognitive rehabilitation for these individuals, I have to have a strong shout out to my colleagues at Walter Reed here in Bethesda. The program at Walter Reed for assessment, diagnosis, confirmation, and rehabilitation is overwhelmingly effective and successful. And for those individuals who've been enrolled in that program, after going through the necessary diagnostic assessment and confirmatory vetting, well, they have said for the most part that this program has been very, very successful for them on both a subjective level as well as objectively being able to restore certain aspects of their capability and functionality. So I think that answers the first question. I mean, this has to be done in a stepwise fashion. Again, I'm not discouraging individuals from getting in touch with me or getting in touch with any of the other personnel who publicly are identified as being involved with various aspects of these AHIs. But even those individuals who get in touch with me, the first question I ask them is, have you been to your physician? What are those reports? Why don't you have your physician get in touch with me and let me speak with your physician? Of course, obviously give your physician the necessary HIPAA requirements and authorizations to be able to discuss your case with me. And then at that point, if your physician feels this needs to be referred to some other resource, my usual recommendation is for them to go to their local public health officer with these assertions so that the individual can at least be recognized as falling into this proverbial pipeline. At that point, it goes up the chain, so to speak, the colloquial chain, that may then be referred back to more national public health and public security resources, with the ultimate idea that if, in fact, these cases are assessed to then be indicative of an AHI of the Havana syndrome type, these individuals be referred and directed to the program of Walter Reed. So that's sort of the algorithm. That's the step fashion by which I would recommend people to go through. And again, my feeling is irrespective of whatever is wrong with you, if there is something wrong with you, the primacy of your best interest is the goal of medicine, and you should seek treatment and be treated for that.
Do you feel this is on doctors' radar enough?
No, I don't. Okay. And let me explain. So the reason I don't think it has been is because there has been very ambiguous communication about it for a number of years. And a lot of that ambiguity has created sort of a fog of awareness. I mean, we're still bantering around the idea of what's psychogenic or sociogenic, and it's very easy to dismiss everything as psychogenic or sociogenic.
Yes, totally.
And as a consequence of doing that, I think you run a definitive risk that veridical cases will fall between the cracks.
Yeah.
I also think that there are cases of other things that would require a very specific and granular diagnosis, and some of the neuro-otological disorders, et cetera, they too may be falling through the cracks. And I also think what that has done is that's created a relative asymmetry in terms of clinicians' awareness and therefore their receptivity to understanding what may be going on with these cases. The patient's willingness, eagerness, and relative enthusiasm for communicating these things if in fact they feel they've been subjected to them. So dissonance occurs.
Yeah.
Is it getting somewhat better? I would hope so, but I will tell you, one of the things that, we have found is that there is an ongoing and sustained effort of misinformation about this, with revitalizations of the psychogenic and sociogenic hypothesis. And again, I'm not at all denying the reality that many, many cases subsequent to Havana are fully representative of psycho and sociogenic disorders and or functional neurological disorders, as well as a variety of other biological and biopsychosocial problems. But again, I think it becomes important here to really parse and differentiate the dirty bathwater from the clean, the toys in the tub, and the baby. Each and all of them, I think, have meritable grounds for being assessed appropriately. So as we know what to proverbially discard, what to hang on to, what's dirty, what's clean, what's valuable. So I think that's become a real issue. I think the other issue is that there's not an overall understanding or comprehensibility of what the real pathways are, as I just described. In other words, where do we go from here? What could a clinician do if, in fact, they suspect the patient might actually have this? How do they refer to their local public health agency? How might they advance this somewhat further? Could they, in fact, call me or one of the other individuals who publicly is attributed to working on aspects of the cases? And what to say? Well, yeah, they could. They certainly can, and others have in the past. And that obviously represents one potential vector to trajectorize what will be right and good care of these individuals. So I think that an increased knowledge is important. And this then speaks to your latter. In other words, what are we doing about this? What we have advocated very strongly is a fourth thrust approach. Let me explain. Each one of these thrusts are not mutually exclusive. In fact, they're rather interdependent. The first is there needs to be an increased awareness of the veridicality, the real problem here. What is the real problem? And in that awareness, there also needs to be explicit distinction and differentiation of these different problem sets. What represents those things of the anomalous health incident of the Havana syndrome type? What represent those things that may be reflective of the worried well? What represent those things that may be reflective of other disorders, conditions, whether coexistent or pre-existent, that perhaps can present in these ways, as well as what types of things may be strongly representative of socio and psychogenic phenomenon and functional neurological disorders, or even explicit psychiatric and psychiatric or psychological underlay or overlay. So awareness and veridical awareness, I think, is paramount here. And there has been a lot of miscommunication, a lot of misinformation, some of it, by the way, intentional, others not. And there's also been a fair amount of misapprehension, misunderstanding, both from the biomedical community as well as from the general public, which would be the putative patient community. So awareness is critical. Genuine, authentic, reliable, valid awareness based upon verifiable information. The second aspect of that is quantification. So this is what we're really talking about when we look at the numbers. So if we're looking at that core set of signs and symptoms that represent the kernel of that constellation, that represent the basis of the syndrome, quantifying these objective features and mapping these objective features onto particular subjective characteristics and metadata of the individual become very, very important to establish the demographics an epidemiology of what's real and what is not, as regards to, is it an AHI of the Havana syndrome type or something else? But also quantifying the burden and risk, the real burden and risk, not only of the current cases, but what are we seeing with regard to incidence of cases and prevalence of cases? Are these cases going up? Is this static? Are we seeing a diminution of reported cases? What are the factors that influence not only reports of cases, but those cases that may be veridical in terms of being AHIs of this sort? So in other words, a multifactorial analysis is necessary not only to qualify what's AHI Havana and what isn't, but to quantify those factors in terms of their prevalence, their incidence, their occurrence, and their relative, if you will, ratios within any particular collective or population of those people who are affected. In doing that, you go one step further. You really estimate what the risk and threat here is. And estimating the real risk and threat is critical if, in fact, you're going to mobilize the necessary resources for continued iterative assessment if this is viewed as a problem or an issue in evolution. Number two, it's equally important for the dedication of those resources for detection, mitigation, and prevention, which then represents the third thrust, which is dedicated resources, multi-level, multi-componential resources for mitigating the problem. Now, mitigating the problem, again, requires accurate detection. And once you've detected what these things are and the parameters by which they are operating to affect individuals, you can then deter those types of effects two ways. You can do it environmentally and provide individuals relatively safe spaces that are insulated against these types of things, but you can also detect personally, bodily, and then in those ways, perhaps provide those means that might mitigate the effects on a direct individual. Various forms of protective engagement, for example, bodily gear or other forms of accoutrements that can be utilized that can then decrease the effects, mitigate the effects, or block the effects on an individual. And you want to go one step further. Okay. And that last step is the important one. How do you prevent this stuff?
Right.
Not just how do you deter it, how do you block it? How do you actually prevent it? This is a larger discussion. I mean, certainly a larger discussion than I think entails identification of at least who the possible, if not probable, offending agents and actors are. The actual nature of the technology in terms of this is the actual smoking gun type of thing, or at least a prototype of the smoking gun. And then there needs to be some directed movement, some mobilization to be able to identify this as a real risk and threat to public safety, public health, and national security and defense, which then takes that into the next realm of being a consideration for a variety of different agencies. Homeland Security, local police departments, the intelligence community in and across all of its various entities, the Department of Defense, as well as larger political posturing so as to be able to create the necessary discourses to identify, hey, this is out there, we recognize this is out there, this represents the new battlescape, if you will, that these devices are indeed weaponizable to these extents. And therefore, there needs to be some movement and traction on the governance, oversight, regulation, and constraint of these devices and or what their use means militarily and or politically. That takes not just a coordinated governmental effect. It moves away from partisan posturing. It really takes a whole of nation effect. I mean, it takes a cooperative effect in and across the various levels of national integrity, from the local to the federal. Variety of agencies, both within the government, local as well as regional and national, as well as external to government entities, research enterprises, the commercial enterprises. And of course, I think responsible reporting and accurate fiction and elucidation of the factuality of these things by media. And that can be difficult because, again, not to castigate the media at all, but podcasts such as this, I think, are exceedingly informative. Because what they seek to do is to provide relatively clear information in an unbiased way that really presents the full palette of information, knowledge that is available at this point, that allows the educated audience consumer to be able to comprehend that information, gain it, perhaps understand it, and then use it in key ways in a non-inflammatory and non-conspiratorial approach. I think that's critical.
Yeah, and the reason I started to do the podcast is just to have conversations with experts and talk about these timely public health issues. I think it, and I have nothing against the media. I just think it's so harder today with the digital landscape, and it's, you know, you trying to get the best headline to get the most clicks, and that turns into money and that turns into paychecks. So I don't know.
No, I mean, again, it's not any direct castigation.
Of course, of no.
The media. It's just that, you know, given the nature of the current technology and sort of the climate, if you will, of the global sphere, the information sphere, and there's ubiquitous information online. And the level of competition that you're seeing for media reporting, particularly that which is financially remunerable, is very, very different than it was a decade or two decades ago. We have dedicated science and medicine reporters who are really focal to these things. Yeah. Now what you tend to find is it really is something more of a sensationalist grab, where many outlets, as well as many actors in the media, are sort of contributory to this very, very ubiquitous information flow. What can happen is there can be a bastardization of information, not intentionally, sort of like playing the old telegraph game they did when you kid. I tell you something, you tell somebody else. By the time it gets halfway around the block, the story is quite different.
Yeah.
And there may also be the need for certain aspects of sensationalism, taking certain things out of context so as to be able to gain an oomph factor, an impact factor that generates views, reads, likes, etc. And all those things fit into the overall climate that predicates certain economic variables with the way the media is being engage. So, I mean, I think recognition of those factors is important, because recognition is the first step towards revision, right?
I agree. Yeah, that's with anything. Personal change, you need self-awareness first and foremost. You need to be honest with yourself too, right? At the same time. Awareness and honesty. This was great. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day and telling us more about this. It's a complicated issue. It's intriguing. And, you know, I hope that there is that when you were explaining things that, you know, should happen in the future, that's a lot of resources. It's a lot of personnel involved, but I hope that there is the dedication there, and that happens on the level you describe. It's not easy.
No, as do I, but the pragmatist in me, not necessarily the optimist or the pessimist, the pragmatist in me is pleased, is encouraged by the tractionable level of activity in this space that I've seen over the past couple of years. And the overall, not only the interest, but the integrative dedication to understanding these phenomena and what they may entail and obtain. And also what that then means for the larger picture as relates to the use of bioscience and biotechnology in those ways that might be problematic to public safety and health, as well as national security and defense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could think about scenarios here that go levels beyond what's happening now, but scary, scary stuff. But and you're confident that we can one day prevent this and detect it? And
I am. Based upon, I think, the progress that we've seen to date, there has been, I think, significant developments made in those areas of detection, deterrence, mitigation, and possible prevention. But of course, like anything else, this represents a field in evolution. And as happens so often, you're sort of getting the table tennis effect. In other words, you do something, your peer competitor, adversary does something else, and then there's that relative level of back and forth that is just so representative of these types of engagements, particularly when you have multinational players on a global stage. So the level of scientific and technological competition is high. The areas for cooperation and collaboration, I think, is equally high. But like anything else, these have to be plotted against relative gains, relative losses, intent, leverage, and power. And so I think it becomes very important to dedicate those resources so as to be able to remain at least a pace, if not somewhat ahead, of how the science and technology can develop in those ways that are not only liable for benevolent and beneficent means and ends, but also can be interpreted in terms of what other groups may think is good for them, good for their ideology, their agendas, and whatever. Mm-hmm. And that includes the potential ways that these things might be used to negatively affect competitors or adversaries.
I guess, geez, the evolution of weapons. It's scary. They as time goes on, it gets scarier and scarier. My grandfather always was like, "Oh, we're going to destroy ourselves one day." I don't know if that's true or not. He was also not an optimist, though.
I think it's appropriate to be as pragmatic as you can be, and then try to be prudent based upon your pragmatism. So you balance, I think, a hopeful sense of optimism,
yeah,
with kind of a nihilistic sort of pessimism, and kind of come out somewhere in between. Excuse me, and hope that you can actually influence the flow of those things that are being done in those ways that are going to be purposive,
yeah,
towards doing things that are rightly and good, really, and justifiable for public safety, public health, and public interest.
Yeah, yeah. And try to get along with people, I guess. Thank you so much. I appreciate this.
And thank you so, so much for your interest in my work. And thank you very, very much for your dedicated attention to this problem. And I think that, again, to reiterate, not to sound like a broken record, it's these types of well-informed podcasts that I think are very, very important to those individuals who have been subjected not only to these types of things,
yeah,
but maybe also suffering from a variety of undiagnosed and heretofore unassessed disorders and conditions that require medical attention. So thanks for putting this on the air, and thanks for your interest in what it is that I do.
Absolutely. And those are the people that need to come first, you know, and get their story out there. And that can be very scary and discouraging when people don't believe you or take you seriously, and especially when you're in a certain mind frame. So absolutely. I agree
with
you.
Thank you so much for your interest in the work, and thanks for spending some time with me.
Appreciate absolutely. It. Enjoy the rest of your day there. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. It's such an interesting topic because it's a mystery, but also it's so important to learn about it so we can help those who are affected and stop it from happening if we can. Please feel free to share the episode, subscribe, tell your friends, tell your enemies, the more the merrier. If you have comments, ideas, questions, you can reach me through my blog/website, bloomingwellness.com. You should know that I do not write all the blogs there or review all of them, but the ones I write should be labeled. Okay, and now for the closing quote. This one has to do with staying curious and, in my mind, asking questions while flowing with the uncertainty inevitable to life. It's by Vincent van Gogh, I hope. At least that's what Goodreads told me. And here it goes. If I cease searching, then woe is me. I am lost. That is how I look at it. Keep going, come what may. All right, guys, that's it. I hope you tune in next time. And you know, thanks for supporting the show. If you have, I really appreciate it. And all of that. Okay, bye-bye.